Hi, and welcome to the Future of Dermatology podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Farah Kamangar, board-certified dermatologist. We are here to talk about anything and everything dermatology-related. You'll hear from me and my guests, who are dermatologists, physicians, experts, scientists, residents, and medical students in the field of dermatology. We publish weekly, so if you like what you hear, hit that subscribe button and show us some love, and thank you for joining us.
Welcome back to the Future Dermatology Podcast. This is our part two of our three-part series on the aryl hydrocarbon receptor agonist, and specifically we're going to talk about tapinarof now in this one. So, and Dr. Bhutani, of course, is an expert in this. Many talks on psoriasis in general, but topical therapies and all the novel emerging therapies.
Yeah, it's a really exciting time for topicals and psoriasis.
It's been like steroids for so long now.
Or, you know, we had other topicals, like, you know, calcipotriene and things, but, you know, nothing that, but, you know, nothing that really worked all that well. Right. So, so I think this is an exciting time because now we have a lot of non-steroidal therapies that really do work great. So
really, really well. And actually we'll talk next about the access. I think still vitamin D derivatives are on the step therapies anyway, before these like newer therapies are approved. So we'll talk about that part two. But I would love to hear from you just efficacy, safety, anything on tapinarof.
I think tapinarof, you know, it's now FDA approved for psoriasis. And then, you know, we'll soon hopefully have an indication for atopic dermatitis down the line. But for psoriasis, I think it's been a great, great option. They had two large phase three studies basically that were done, over 1,000 patients from anywhere. They had patients from like mild, moderate, and severe psoriasis. So like all across the board, but mainly moderate psoriasis. I think the bulk of the patients in that study had moderate psoriasis. And they were treated for 12 weeks once daily with tapinarof versus, you know, vehicle. And we showed that about, you know, 35 to 40% of these patients had clear or almost clear skin at the end of 12 weeks. So again, you know, first you think about it and you're like, well, 30%, whatever, you know, but it's a non-steroid. And I think that's the one thing to remember. It's like, you know, we're used to clearing people with, you know, clobetasol, super potent topical steroids that potentially could have, you know, long-term side effects, but we're using a non-steroidal topical. And I don't think we've ever seen results like that, you know, with the non-steroid. And so, you know, I oftentimes, when I'm teaching, I talk about when we're treating psoriasis with topicals, you have like your clearance phase, you know, what do you use during your clearance phase? And then what do you use during your maintenance phase? And traditionally it's always like steroids for clearance. And then you move into maybe a non-steroid or steroids less frequently during the maintenance phase. But now I think with drugs, like, you know, tapinarof, we have one drug that can be both your clearance and your maintenance, because we don't have to worry about how long you use it, where you use it on the body. It's one prescription. It's super easy for patients. And so that's what I really like about tapinarof.
Actually, it's good to hear what your clinical, about how you're doing it now. I mean, access-wise, we'll talk about that in a second.
Probably are
doing the steroids first. And a lot of patients probably come to us, even maybe from primary care, even if they haven't seen dermatology, with some sort of steroid.
That's
probably happened to some extent. But let's say you get, like, you can have access to any medications, step therapies weren't an issue. Somebody came in right now and just had, like, really, like, big plaque. What would be, like, your go-to? Would you kind of, like, hit it with clobetasol for a few days, but then, like, concomitantly kind of start one of these therapies?
I think it would depend on kind of, like, how angry those plaques are. So if somebody's coming in with, like, a beefy red, super thick indurated plaque, I think I'm still reaching for the clobetasol, right? It's like, you need to cool that down. You need to thin it out a little bit. But, you know, if they're coming in with just kind of like regular, like I said, moderate psoriasis, I definitely think, you know, these non-steroids are in the game. And I would talk about them. And a lot of times patients come to me, they are using the steroid already. And especially, you know, at an academic center, you know, I'm usually not the first dermatologist they've seen. And so I think, you know, for those patients also, just kind of switching to something different can sometimes help.
Absolutely. And it's so true too, because by the time they get to us too, and at PAMP as well, by the time they get to us, they've tried these different things. So it almost feels so silly to give them like another
one. Right. Yeah. And that's not what they want either. They're coming to us to kind of get the cutting edge therapies, right? So
therapies.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
And then how about all the, like with the calcineurin inhibitors with the Verdi?
Yeah.
Any of that? Was any of that seen in with application? Let's say like a super erythematous inflammatory lesion. Is it pretty easy to apply?
Yeah, I think. Yeah, totally. I think that's a great point because I think with our older non-steroids, we kind of had to cool down the plaque before you put on like a vitamin D or before you put on like a tacrolimus or something because it could irritate the skin, right? It could cause that burning sensation. So we always cooled it down with the steroid and then we like slowly transitioned into this non-steroid. That's not really the case with tapinarof. Basically, you can apply it to really inflamed skin and we don't really run into problems that way. So it's nice. There are some, you know, side effects that we're seeing in the clinical trials. And I think in clinical practice that we are seeing, and I think the big one that comes up a lot is the folliculitis issue. In my own personal experience, I don't think it's related to like what the baseline severity of the plaque looked like. I think for some patients, they just develop it and others, they don't. And I don't think we know exactly what the mechanism is. But basically the folliculitis is that, you know, on the areas where the medication is being applied, patients can kind of develop almost these like small erythematous papules. Sometimes they're pustular, but most of the times it's almost more of like these keratotic papules, more like KP almost. They're like tiny little bumps. And it's really interesting because, you know, we talked about in the last episode, the relationship or you know, the mechanism of action of coal tar being also probably related to aryl hydrocarbon receptor. And, you know, tar folliculitis was something that we saw all the time in Geckerman treatment. And we used to think about that it was probably the occlusion piece of it because we're putting like this thick ointment, then we're wrapping it with saran wrap. And so I always used to think it's like we're just occluding their follicles and, you know, they're getting inflamed and irritated. But you know, it's probably a mechanism of the aryl hydrocarbon receptor that's actually causing this folliculitis.
That's actually really interesting. Right? Yeah. It's one of the things that we didn't really think about.
Yeah.
But we think about it is, and then also the KP pieces, I think, really interesting.
So yeah.
Everybody asks how to treat keratosis pilaris.
Yeah.
Nothing works. So it's like somebody figures out how to treat. So if they can reverse engineer this.
Yes. That's a great point. Antagonist. There you go. You're welcome, developers out there. Yeah, exactly.
And also all biotech.
Yes.
Really interesting. This is probably completely unrelated, but we talked last time about like kind of the large search of what's happening in other fields. And there was some mention of aryl hydrocarbon receptors even being involved in things like chloracne, because they can be a ligand for
receptor
for exogenous things as well.
Yeah.
As endogenous
triggers.
So it's probably unrelated, but there are these like little things in different areas.
Yeah.
Like acne or these papules or like keratosis pilaris like eruptions. So
yeah, I'm sure we'll learn more about it in the next few years. I think we're gonna learn about what exactly is causing that folliculitis and you know causing that.
Interesting. Yeah. And it also happened like at a high enough rate, not everybody.
It was like about close to 20%, you know, in the psoriasis trials. In the atopic dermatitis trials that are the data has been presented, it's a little lower. It's like about like, you know, a little closer to 10%, but definitely still there. So yeah, it's a thing. It's real. It's real. Yeah.
So yeah. Atopic derm, they're seeing less of the folliculitis?
A little less of the folliculitis. Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing just makes me think of, which was another interesting part of their tapinarof mechanism of action, it seems to be increasing filaggrin lower.
Yeah.
Probably why it's working in atopic.
Yeah. I think it's really fascinating because, you know, I think for many years we've kind of like diverted the two diseases, like psoriasis is like a Th17 mediated disease. And then atopic dermatitis is, you know, this Th2 mediated disease. But there probably is this like upstream common pathway. And I think that's what aryl hydrocarbon receptor gets to. And that's what coal tar got to, right? Because Geckerman therapy worked for everything, you know? So there is this upstream pathway. And so again, I think that's where the aryl hydrocarbon receptor. So I think it's really interesting that it works for both diseases.
If there's some connection there between like the decreased folliculitis and the atopic dermatitis.
Yeah.
Maybe less filaggrin open to start with.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great thought.
More as they study more diseases too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does this in this population?
Yeah. Yeah.
But in the atopic derm population, was it the
headaches? I think headaches were slightly higher in the atopic derm population, but not too much higher. You know, it wasn't just, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's a small, you know, group of patients. So we have to kind of take that into account. But
headaches is probably the third, right? You have just skipped over that.
Dermatitis. Yeah. Yeah. So in the psoriasis trials, they did see, I think it was like 5-ish% or so of patients got this dermatitis. And I think originally it was thought, you know, is this like an irritant contact dermatitis? Isn't it an allergic contact dermatitis? You know, what is actually going on? But interestingly, they did a study where they, you know, used tapinarof on kind of normal skin and patients like patch tested them basically and didn't find any allergic contact dermatitis. So we don't think it's an allergic piece. And then for the irritant piece, it's interesting because they just released data from a phase 4 open label trial using tapinarof in like intertriginous areas. So areas like the groin and the axilla, so these folds, you'd think, yeah. And they didn't.
The medicine's just being
exactly. Out. And they still saw a little bit of dermatitis. I mean, that did come up, but they didn't see more of it. So it's interesting. And overall, the patients tolerated it really well in those intertriginous areas. So I don't think it's also an irritant effect.
What's going on?
Yeah. So I don't know. We see, you know, even in biologic trials, you know, especially with the IL-17s, I think, for example, there were patients who developed, you know, we treated their psoriasis goes away, but then they end up developing a dermatitis. And we always talk about this like TH1, TH2 balance, and like we kind of, or TH17, TH2 balance. And so once you're kind of like inhibiting one pathway, then the TH2 kind of takes over. And so I always think like, I think these patients are just patients who might have kind of both diseases, you know, like I see a handful of them at UCSF. I've talked to, you know, others around the country, patients that have both psoriasis and some type of dermatitis, and it just becomes this balancing act in trying to treat them. So maybe that's what we were seeing with those dermatitis patients. We're not quite sure, but
yeah, that's probably it. It's not happening to everybody.
It's not happening to everybody. Yeah.
I think one patient I think that I've seen the dermatitis and you're right, it just kind of looked like, and I think it clinically can look different, but
yeah,
for this patient, it just looked like kind of dermal hypersensitivity.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, let's just stop it, I guess.
Exactly. Exactly. And sure enough, it works. Yeah. I mean, you stop it and it goes away. Same with the folliculitis. And so that's why I tell people, like, don't be afraid to use it because of the folliculitis. Because worst case, you either stop it and it goes away, or you like tell them to use it a little less often and it gets better. So
this patient, this is just literally one patient, so I don't think
it's
going to be great, but the rash then cleared and he wasn't applying it for too long before the dermatitis appeared.
Yeah.
And he stopped it. Could have been just a clomidazole working too, but then his psoriasis looked great. But there's so many factors.
Yeah.
Clomidazole and other
right,
things.
So right. Yeah.
I was like, well, does that mean it
works? It works. Yeah.
I don't know if we can say.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think for the most part, it's patients tolerate it pretty well. And a lot of times they're like, I'm happy with these little red bumps as long as my giant psoriasis plaque is gone, you know? So, you know, in the trials, the phase 3 trials, like less than 2% of patients actually stopped the medication because of any of these, you know, adverse events. So
that was kind of the same for Gekkonen patients, right? They would even have
they kept on going. Started, yeah.
They kept going.
Yeah.
They would just
yeah.
be with the decrease in inflammation, itch, the scaling.
Yeah.
And you can have shedding around the house.
Yeah.
Those are the things that the patients care about most. So that seems like consistent with
that.
Yeah. Yeah. With.
Totally.
With the treatment. And the third was headaches, which is really interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the data I've seen is the headaches are not necessarily correlated with increased serum levels.
Right, right.
And the patients that are getting this, it's not like anything you would think where it's like, well, it's just a lot forming into their system.
Yeah.
But that doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah. And again, something that we always saw with Gekkonen therapy, and I think we always attributed it to like it smells and you, exactly. You're exhausted. The smell of tar, you know, could give people a headache. I remember I got headaches when I first started working at the psoriasis center, like the first couple of weeks I had headaches. And so who knows? I don't think we know, you know, the way adverse events are collected in clinical trials as well is, you know, anything that has happened to the patient gets reported as an adverse event. And I think, you know, people get headaches. And so it's a very common. So I think until we compare the rate of headaches in this population to, for example, you know, a psoriasis population who's, you know, not. So anyways,
it's hard to know.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And then we see sometimes like headaches with, not all the time, but even with just like topical tretinoin. Very different.
Totally.
It's interesting. And we know, of course, if you're taking like isotretinoin and you get a headache, like they just stop it.
There's
something going on there. Maybe you have increased intracranial pressure. With a topical, your brain doesn't even go to those.
Yeah.
Is there some neural involvement. I did look up aryl hydrocarbon receptors and the nervous system.
Oh, okay.
And the receptors are there.
Wow.
But then again, you're not really seeing an increased level in the serum.
Yes, exactly. They've done like maximal use studies. Yeah.
Getting into this, into the bloodstream and like going and crossing your blood-brain barriers, that's probably unlikely. But then there's all of these connections we know between the skin and the nervous system, right?
That's super interesting. Yeah. And I think again, when we, you know, hopefully get the AD indication and we learn more about kind of the impact, like the patients in the AD trials really had a good improvement in their itch too, you know, over time. And now as we're learning more about kind of, you know, how itch is neurally mediated in addition to, you know, the inflammatory piece, I think that'll be really interesting.
Maybe that's the next step.
Honestly. We're just developing like five studies in the last like 20 in the last 20 minutes.
Something happening there, maybe not. But yeah, so we talked about efficacy. We talked about safety profile, and next, of course, we'll talk about kind of access and how to get it as well.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of what other things we can kind of talk about with the. We talked about the mechanism, and just want to make sure we cover all things with the efficacy of the medication. Mechanism wise, actually, I don't know if we talked much about the actual lowering of like TNF-alpha. It's been shown to do all of these things.
Right? Yeah.
TNF-alpha, decrease.
IL-17. Yeah. And like you said, you know, it's kind of hitting these different pathways. So there's like the inflammatory, you know, impact. So, you know, decreasing levels of these cytokines. But then there's this kind of like antioxidant effect potentially through like the NRF2 pathway and, you know, things like that. And then, like you already mentioned, the skin barrier, the, you know, the studies have also shown that using tapinarof can also improve the skin barrier function and probably why it works for AD as well. So it's just, it's really interesting that it has all these different effects.
How much does psoriasis, and I don't know what the data actually is.
Yeah,
how
I
much
think
does it improve if you just improve barrier.
Yeah, I think there's been studies to show that, you know, even just like moisturization alone can help, you know, improve inflammation in psoriasis. And it's not just the appearance, because people are like, well, yeah, if you're moisturizing, the scales get better and it's going to look better. But it's not just that. They've done studies where they looked at inflammation after just using moisturization and they saw impact. So I think, you know, we don't traditionally think of psoriasis as a disease of barrier dysfunction. But I think there is something to it. And I think there is something there. So oftentimes, you know, using occlusion with things like the hydrogel patch or, you know, other things that we did in the past, can help patients with psoriasis. I don't think it's just a mechanism that like, okay, the topical is penetrating deeper. That's not all it's doing. I think there's something else there. Yeah.
And I think for patients all the time too, if I'm a psoriasis patients, at some point they kind of catch on to like, they really need to stay hydrated.
Yeah.
I've heard this from a lot. Like,
yeah.
If they just even are slightly dehydrated,
totally,
they see a flare. And I think we hear so many things from patients in clinic, kind of different trends and things like that. Some are real, some are not.
Yeah.
I usually listen to patients. I'm like, well, if you're seeing it,
exactly.
There.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This seems to be like the patients are noticing it, this flare when they're getting dehydrated.
Right.
It's drier, mm-hmm. more severe, totally dehydrated.
We always talk about the winter flare, right? I mean, at least here in California, when our winter is, you know, right now, basically. And as the weather gets cooler, you know, patients, the number of patients who have psoriasis in clinic goes up, you know, our phototherapy numbers are going up, you know, people are having flares of their disease. So that's probably, you know, also related there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We see these trends and now we're just kind of finding liquid mechanisms.
Totally. But I think it's important because I think we also need to be talking to our psoriasis patients about gentle skincare techniques and, you know, things like that, where we don't, you know, we're very used to talking about our atopic patients about that, but I think the psoriasis patients also need the same education. Yes, like
lifestyle.
Yeah.
Perfect. And then the last one we asked about what we see for the last question, the future of tapinarof. So we kind of answered that, but anything else?
Yeah.
Efficacy, the mechanism, I guess atopic derm.
Yeah.
The future of what we see for it.
Totally.
In that.
Yeah.
Early trials, early data.
Yeah. I mean, the data looks really great. The trials that were done were actually in patients with more moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. So they weren't kind of messing around with the mild patients. They were going straight for the more severe patients. And the results are really great. You know, about like 50% or so of patients had clear, almost clear skin after the end of the trial. So I almost think that the atopic derm results are, you know, almost slightly more impressive than the psoriasis results. So we'll see. Yeah.
Again, no stinging.
Yeah, not that we can see. Yeah, same side effects. I think, you know, the folliculitis contact derm and maybe this small amount of headaches are the same things that they saw in atopic derm. So nothing new, no new signals. Yeah.
The topical, especially when you get to the younger atopic derm patients, if you put anything on them that burns or
stings, yes,
the same,
yeah,
you know, you're done. You're
yes, done. Yeah, yeah.
So I think the efficacy, of course, is great.
Exactly.
The efficacy, but it's all those kind of real life.
Yeah.
And for the eczema, I guess we'll see what the indication that comes out. Are they studying it?
They're studying it in younger individuals, but yeah, we don't know what the, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or sometimes 12, you know, we'll see. We'll see what they come up with. But yeah, I do think that pediatric indications would be great for tapinarof for those reasons. Exactly. I think parents would love using a non-steroid and something that's really well tolerated.
And that concludes our part two about efficacy and safety of tapinarof. And then next we'll go to the access. So basically,
the hard part.
Thank you for listening to the Future of Dermatology podcast. Remember to hit that subscribe button and share the podcast with your friends. The more you share and subscribe, the more we'll be able to grow and share our dermatology knowledge. If you have burning dermatology questions, feel free to leave them in the comment below, and we would love to address them in a future episode. And please note that this podcast is not intended to substitute for medical advice from your doctor.